I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A scathing Justice Department audit was released today, which says the FBI improperly used the USA Patriot Act to obtain people's personal information. Among other things, the 126-page audit says the FBI underreported how often it asked businesses to turn over customers' information, and it says the Bureau sometimes received the information without proper authorization. FBI Director Robert Mueller called the audit a fair review of a useful investigative tool, but he said the deficiencies it outlined are unacceptable.
But the question should and must be asked, how could this happen? Who is accountable? And the answer to that is, I am to be held accountable.
Well, joining us now is Washington Post reporter John Solomon, who's been following this story. John, this audit is highly critical. It cites mistakes on the part of the FBI agents and says shoddy record keeping was to blame. What do you think is the overarching message to be taken from this audit?
Well, I think you're starting to see it play out in Congress this morning. The entire Capitol Hill is just aflame with concern about this, and I think that the issue is Congress trusted the Justice Department and the FBI and gave it these broad, new, sweeping powers to fight terrorism, and they got a commitment back in return that they would follow very specific safeguards to protect people's civil liberties, and now, 5 years in, 5 to 6 years into the war on terror, they're learning that those safeguards haven't been followed.
So the trust has been broken here.
I think that that's right, and one of the instant reactions is you're seeing both Republicans and Democrats saying they're willing to consider scaling back the Patriot Act. Now, we haven't heard Republicans saying that, you know, since the war began, but they're talking about scaling back the Patriot Act in response to this.
And the audit itself, are we talking about improper or illegal activities or both here on the part of the FBI?
I think both. One of the things that the Inspector General who did this report concluded was that they found no evidence of a deliberate attempt to just evade laws, just do what we want. There was none of that, but systematic, widespread misapplication of the law, not following the procedures and policies, and in some cases, because of the things they did, they actually broke the law. For instance, 700 times people's telephone record, toll records were obtained without a national security letter even being issued. And you have to get those records either by subpoena or national security letter. 700 times it didn't happen, and yet the FBI got those records.
And explain, most of this audit does involve those national security letters, and those are the letters that the Bureau issues to secretly get customers' information. Can you explain exactly what those are?
That's right. Before 9/11, that was a very arcane tool that the Justice Department seldom used. And after 9/11, they got this permission. The argument is that when you're pursuing terrorists, you have to move very quickly. You can't wait for judges to approve things or grand juries to issue subpoenas. So they got this power, basically a letter-writing power that says, I certify there's a national security need here, and we need to get this information right away to follow a lead. And therefore, phone records that normally required a grand jury subpoena or court approval are given to the FBI just by the writing of a letter.
And how widespread would you say is the use of these letters?
In what we learned last night in our story is that 19,000 of these letters were issued in 2005 alone. That's the last year for which there are full records. And over the last 3 years, more than 150,000 different pieces of telephone and internet records have been obtained using these letters. So it's very widespread use now.
If this report says it wasn't really a deliberate attempt to sort of evade any laws or anything like that, I'm wondering, are some people then thinking that maybe it's an organizational issue?
I think that that's right. I mean, there has been, since after the very recent days after 9/11, a very big concern that the FBI culturally and systematically is not well-equipped to fight the war on terror. And, you know, lots of money has been given to them. Lots of laws have been changed to give them more power. And I think what the thinking now on the Hill and even in the Justice Department is the Bureau still hasn't made enough adaptions, enough changes to its culture, its mindset, its adherence to basic rules and procedures to maybe deserve the power that it's been given. And that's a lot of the reaction that we're hearing today.
You mentioned phone records. What else, what other kind of information can be requested with these national
security?
Basically,
national security letters, you can get three types of information. The most common and most frequently used, 80 to 90% of the time, is instant long-distance telephone records. Who called who, when, for how long, where the numbers are going. So if you're chasing a terrorist and you want to know everybody called in the last hour or two, you can get them that quickly. Second form, less common, but because terrorists increasingly are using the Internet, you can get internet subscriber information, whose account sent that email. You can't get the contents of the email with a letter, but you can at least get who sent who was emailing who in the last day, the last 7 days, whatever you need. And then a final and one of the more sensitive pieces of information you can get in some circumstances is instantaneous bank information, who I transacted business with, who used my credit card, where did I transfer money in the last 24 hours or whatever.
That's a lot of information.
It is. They're really the crown jewels of American civil liberties.
You know, FBI Director Robert Mueller has admitted that there were mistakes made. He says he takes responsibility. Do you think that there will be some turnover within the agency because of this?
Yeah, I think there's a process underway, which we reported last night. They've impaneled a board of what are known as senior inspectors, basically the veteran, the top veteran agents of the FBI, to go back and try to figure out who was responsible, what who did what wrong, who's responsible, and what's the appropriate discipline. So I think you might see some clear accountability actions coming down in the next few weeks or months.
And then a likely review of the Patriot Act.
I think that's gaining steam as we speak today. There were several Republicans already committed to it this morning. Democrats certainly would like to do that. They've been arguing that the Patriot Act's too broad even before this episode.
John Solomon, a reporter for The Washington Post, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Have a great day.
Thanks. President Bush is in Brazil today as part of a five-nation tour of Latin America. One of the objectives of the trip is the ethanol development agreement announced today with Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. President Bush says the agreement's a way to boost alternative fuel production throughout the Americas. In the U.S., ethanol is made largely from corn, but in Brazil, it's made from sugarcane. Well, joining us from the BBC studios in Sao Paulo is Tim Hirsch, a journalist who writes about the environment and is based in Brazil. Welcome.
Hi.
Before we get to the ethanol deal, President Bush's visit is causing a lot of protests in Brazil and in Colombia, where President Bush is going later in this trip. Are these protests tied to anything specific, or what's happening with those?
Not really anything specific. I think it's really just an indication of the number of people who are prepared to go out onto the streets of a Latin American city such as Sao Paulo and demonstrate, either peacefully or not, about the arrival of President Bush. If you go by the kind of placards, the signs they were waving, I would say the two biggest issue that the protesters in Sao Paulo were complaining about were the war in Iraq and the president's attitude towards the environment, and specifically global warming. In the case of Sao Paulo, the protests, which took place just before the president's plane touched down, did include quite nasty confrontations with the police, and there were a number of injuries.
Can you tell me what this ethanol deal basically accomplishes?
Well, that remains to be seen in the future. What it accomplishes, what it aims to accomplish, is to take these two countries, the U.S. and Brazil, which together account for something like 70% of the world's ethanol production, and use the combined know-how and experience to try and turn this into more of an international commodity, a little bit more like petroleum, like oil. And the idea is that by doing that, they would be able to transfer the knowledge, experience, and money to countries such as those in Central America and the Caribbean to expand the use of ethanol and other biofuels, indeed. And really, in the words of President Lula, as this deal was being announced, to help in the democratization of access to energy. That's the kind of tone that's being used on this.
By making this push to spread alternative fuels throughout the region, some are saying that President Bush's visit really is a belated attempt to try to offset the influence of Venezuela and its president, Hugo Chavez.
That's right. The White House is denying that there is a direct connection. They're saying this is not the anti-Chavez tour. But there is a very wide interpretation here that this is what it's all about. When you look at the kind of aid that Mr. Chavez has been able to shower on many countries in the region at a time when the perception here has been that Latin America has been virtually ignored by the administration, then you see Mr. Bush arriving in a country like Brazil and talking about ethanol, an alternative to oil, it is inevitably seen as part of a counterattack, if you like, to win the hearts and minds that have been persuaded by Mr. Chavez of Venezuela.
We should also say that Mr. Chavez is on his own Latin American tour, right? He's holding what he calls an anti-imperialist rally at a soccer stadium tomorrow, and that rally is actually going to be, what, about 40 miles away from where President Bush will be touring?
Yes, just across the river, the Rio Plata, in Buenos Aires, Mr. Chavez will be, and Mr. Bush will be just across the river in Uruguay. A very pointed bit of timing, which is clearly, on the part of Mr. Chavez, intended to demonstrate that if this is a contest, a head-to-head, if you like, as to who between Mr. Chavez and Mr. Bush has more influence in Latin America, well, he will say, compare the reception Mr. Chavez, will get in this soccer stadium and the kind of protest that you're seeing accompanying Mr. Bush's visit.
You know, Brazil's President Lula, is saying that the U.S., even though he supports this deal, the U.S. needs to lower its tariffs on Brazilian ethanol imports. Members of his party also are taking part in some of these protests. Are the tariffs on ethanol a big problem?
Well, it is a very serious issue as far as Mr. Lula was concerned. In the joint press facility that they had at an ethanol processing facility, Mr. Bush and Mr. Lula was diplomatic enough not to raise this. But in the days leading up to Mr. Bush's visit, Lula has been saying again and again, look, if the U.S. are really serious in trying to have a good equal partnership with Brazil on encouraging and expanding the use of ethanol, then for goodness sake, end these protectionist measures as Brazil sees it, because the manufacturers of ethanol, the big sugarcane growers in Brazil, say, look, it's ridiculous. We are having to pay in tariffs virtually the cost of production of our sugar if we want it to get into the U.S. The response from the White House has basically been to say, well, that's not on the table because that's a congressional matter. It's not something that's in Mr. Bush's hands. But I think if the view in Brazil certainly is that if the U.S. is going to be serious in really cooperating, getting the cooperation of Brazil, then something will need to be done about those import tariffs.
And what about environmental concerns regarding the increased use of ethanol and what might be happening in Brazil?
Well, it's a very interesting issue because Brazil, from having started so early, has the experience, but also, if you like, has learned the lessons of the potential pitfalls of a widespread use of biofuels, in particular ethanol. And if you go back into the history of the first push to encourage the use of production of ethanol from sugarcane, that did result, it's widely acknowledged now, to a large amount of deforestation, not in the Amazon, but in particularly the northeast Atlantic forest of South America, which in terms of biodiversity, it's seen as being every bit as important as the Amazon.
All right. Tim Hirsch is an environmental journalist based in Brazil. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with us.
A pleasure.
And just ahead, the trial of Lewis Scooter Libby gave journalists a look into the inner workings of the White House. We'll talk with a reporter who covered the proceedings about what she found out. And later in the show, it's a circus without a big top, but where you can see a woman get stuffed inside a suitcase. The Montreal-based Cirque Elwaz comes to the U.S. this spring. We'll have a preview. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. The Lewis Scooter Libby saga isn't over yet. This week, the former top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice for lying to investigators about leaking the identity of an undercover CIA operative. That agent, Valerie Plame Wilson, is set to testify before Congress next week. Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman will head the hearing and says the Libby trial raised questions about the role of other senior Bush administration officials in the leak. The trial also gave a rare glimpse inside the Bush White House and portrayed an administration obsessed with secrecy, where interoffice rivalries led colleagues to guard information from one another. Well, joining us with some analysis of that glimpse is Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein, who covered the Libby trial. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Deborah.
The Bush White House, Amy, and in particular Vice President Cheney's office, have always been talked about as being very secretive. What new information did we get about that during this trial, do you think?
Well, it's interesting because the trial gave all these little glimpses of how the White House was functioning internally in the late spring and early summer of 2003, a couple months after the Iraq War started. And one of the really striking things about the testimony of several witnesses who either did or still do work in the White House is how little they were communicating with one another about what they were doing to try to respond to some of the beginnings of criticism of the war. One of the witnesses who provided the most insight into this phenomenon was a woman named Kathy Martin, who at the time was Mr. Cheney, Vice President Cheney's public affairs director, and Ms. Martin still works at the White House as a deputy communications director for the president. And at one point, she was talking about the White House's strategy of how to respond to criticism of Joseph Wilson, who's married to CIA officer Valerie Plame. And Mr. Wilson had published an op-ed piece early the summer of 2003 alleging that the White House had twisted some intelligence about Iraq weapons capability to justify the war. And one of the things that Kathy Martin said she was advocating was the idea of declassifying a secret document known as a National Intelligence Estimate that essentially provided the government sense of what danger Iraq posed by its weapons ability. And she didn't know that the president already had declassified it, and in fact, Mr. Libby had shared parts of that. He had leaked parts of this document with a newspaper reporter.
Also, former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer testified in the trial that, about this very same issue to a certain degree as well, didn't he?
Well, that's right. At one point, in some pretty vivid testimony, Mr. Fleischer was talking about his rapport with Mr. Libby. And he basically said that he had always liked Scooter Libby. But then he went on to say that unlike other people who worked in the White House, including in the vice president's office, Mr. Libby had never been somebody who was very eager to share information with Ari Fleischer. And in fact, Mr. Fleischer testified that usually when he went to Mr. Libby to ask him for a piece of information, the reply that he got from Mr. Libby was, as Mr. Fleischer put it, "You should check with Dr. Rice." So he just didn't want to share information himself. At least that was the portrait that Ari Fleischer presented at the trial.
So then are we seeing a picture of a White House here that really is very concerned about its public image?
Well, whether that accounts for the secrecy or not, it's definitely true that the little window onto the White House that the trial provided paints a picture of an administration that was very concerned about its public image. And people who at the very highest levels of power in the administration were very personally concerned. And that contrasts with some of what President Bush and Vice President Cheney like to say publicly. I mean, they have repeatedly projected themselves as people who aren't that concerned about how they're portrayed in the press or in public opinion polls. But in the trial, the same witness, Kathy Martin, at one point said that she was instructed by Vice President Cheney to have her staff start keeping a very close track of every news story on television that mentioned the vice president. So that just shows that even the vice president personally was very concerned, at least during that particular time, with how he was being portrayed.
Hmm. And there, you also, in your article in the Washington Post, wrote about a meeting with current National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley.
That's right. He was concerned about a story that had been done the night before by NBC News correspondent Andrea Mitchell. And he had convened a meeting to talk about how to proceed. And during that meeting, he looked around the room at everybody in the room trying to get some sense of who might have spoken to Andrea Mitchell. Well, Kathy Martin testified that she knew that Scooter Libby had spoken to Andrea Mitchell. But instead of acknowledging that he had done so, Ms. Martin testified, her colleague, Mr. Libby, simply looked at the floor.
Is it power? How does power figure into all of this, do you think?
Well, one way of thinking about power is whether there are multiple sources of power in the White House.
Mm.
And, you know, it's been known for a while that there were different people who people were loyal to internally inside the administration. And what becomes very clear at several points in the testimony is that the vice president's office had its own power, and so did Karl Rove's office. He's obviously the chief political advisor to the president. And there was some rivalry between those two offices.
How do you think this has affected journalism, now that journalists know that this is the way that things have been dealt with? Do you think it changes things about how reporters cover the White House?
Well, the trial obviously relied very heavily on journalists as witnesses, and even before the trial began, some of the evidence that was gathered during the grand jury's investigation that led to Mr. Libby being charged was accumulated by interviews with journalists. Some of those reporters fought very strenuously not to have to testify before the grand jury, because there's always been this culture, if not an ironclad law, that journalists believe that they can guarantee confidentiality to sources, particularly in this case, ones who work in sensitive positions inside the government. This case has made absolutely clear that those promises of confidentiality can't always be honored, at least in the context of an aggressive prosecutor who believes the journalists hold the key to the truth.
All right. Well, Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein, she covered the Lewis Scooter Libby trial. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Good to speak with you.
And Monday on Here and Now, the cost of care for wounded veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. A Harvard researcher says the VA is overwhelmed. Also, how to get a young boy to put down the Game Boy and pick up a book and read. That's Monday. Stay ahead. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Across the country, more than 750,000 people are homeless, according to a recent federal report. And for many of these people, there's little chance of getting a bed at a shelter, since there's a shortage of them in many communities. Activists in one city have a solution. Reverend Bruce Wright is pastor director of Refuge Ministries in St. Petersburg, Florida. He's behind a tent city that's been set up to house people who can't find a bed anywhere else. Welcome, Reverend Wright.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Can you say why this tent city was set up in St. Petersburg back in December?
Well, yes. And it actually has an even longer history than that. There was a brief one in the spring of last year, and really the most recent one began in November of last year. And it was primarily because shelter beds were full, and much of the homeless community felt unsafe just sleeping on the street, because there is a rise in hate crimes against the homeless. Of course, in our area, we had two homeless men murdered recently, and several that have been attacked. And so it was the feeling of many of the homeless community that the safest way to protect themselves is to create their own kind of community and erect tents, which is much better and much safer to protect them from the elements as well.
Hmm. So how many tents and people do you have in your tent city right now? Can you describe what it's like there?
Yeah, well, there's actually two sites, and we try to, you know, arrange it so it's self-governed, and we just offer support and input and try to get them hooked up with services along with other agencies. But at the current site in downtown St. Petersburg, there's about 55 to 60 tents, and at the other site across from a soup kitchen is about 25 tents, and there's a number that are sleeping outside without tents.
Hmm. And I understand that the city's not particularly happy about this. There is a temporary permit, right? So tents can remain up for the time being until there's room elsewhere, shelters are elsewhere. But this agreement for the temporary permit apparently came after police were slashing some of the tents. And that was on video. That's now on the internet. So what's happening right now? Right now, both locations can stay, according to the city, where they are?
Well, the city has found a site that they want them to move to. We're in negotiations right now. They're going to make a permit exception for it to be there. The big problem we're running into is that they do not want to make it a flow-through tent city. The other problem is that they are looking at the city running it without any input or direction or control from members of the homeless community and the advocates. And we had requested that they would do that in writing, because there's a feeling that the city is not at a point where they can be trusted, because they shut down the first tent city and then they attacked the second one, slashing the tents.
Hmm. So let me just make this clear. You would like to see a permanent tent city set up that it would continue to accommodate homeless people as needed?
Well, I wouldn't say it's permanent. I would say it's flow-through, whereas people are placed, other people are put in the tents, and eventually what would happen is a small cottage would be built in the place of each tent. The city has thus far ignored it because there is a sense in which the mayor would rather see the homeless out of St. Petersburg. So part of his solution is to criminalize sleeping outside, and in addition to that, supporting the building of a mid-county shelter, and that would be the first place the homeless would go to, which is 15 miles away from St. Pete. It's, you know, in the center of the county.
You mentioned the slashing of the tents that occurred earlier this year. Can you tell me what happened there?
Yes. When the first sanctioned site was shut down, the homeless community moved to two different sites. The city expressed concerns about the one on 9th Street because of safety reasons, and we agreed that there were some issues there. So we agreed to consolidate the two tent cities, and we had a meeting with the lieutenant and the sergeant of the downtown area, as well as the fire marshal, and they had agreed with us that they would take no action against Tent City without informing us. Well, lo and behold, several hours later, when the homeless advocates had left, they came in and with lightning speed really slashed the tents, in some cases with homeless people in them, and dragging them out. We had armed one of the homeless members there, and they caught it all on tape.
Hey, you know, businesses near the tent city, homeowners, they have complained, they've protested about this. They're concerned about safety issues. They're concerned about unruly behavior. What do you say to those concerns that people have about what's happening?
Well, I think some of the unruly behavior that they are alleging is not substantiated. And, you know, one of the things they're saying is they're going to the bathroom everywhere. Well, we know that that's not true because we have portalettes there and they use the portalettes. As far as their safety concerns, homeless people are not the source of crime. If anything, they're the victims of crime far more than any other group.
Mm. You mentioned that these tent cities are essentially self-governed. How does it work?
Well, essentially, the residents themselves choose someone that they deem the most responsible to be kind of the overseer, and then she or he picks a few others to help them. And they have community meetings. Community meetings can be called for any reason. And as a community, they try to work things out by consensus.
Do you think that because of the attention that you've received in St. Petersburg, you mentioned the video that was circulated on the internet of police slashing the tents that have been set up, do you think that coming there has galvanized the homeless community at all, and now it's almost a political message to be there?
You know, at some level, I think that's certainly going to be true. I mean, it first must be noted, though, that the homeless came together out of survival and safety first. You know, we had weather issues, rain and cold. We also had safety issues. You know, again, two homeless men had been murdered, and within a matter of days after the murder is when the tent slashing happened. So any faith they had at all in the protection of the city in relation to crimes against them was yanked away.
What's the best way to address the issue of homelessness in St. Petersburg?
Well, I think it's a two-pronged approach. I think we have to look at immediate shelter, and then we have to look at transitional housing, and then, of course, affordable housing. Most of the homeless community have been there more than a year, and in our county, 40% have been there more than 5 years. So we're not talking about people coming from all over the country. We're talking about people that have been permanent residents in this county, and so we have to look at the affordable housing problem, because while condos are being developed for the rich, they're taking down affordable housing for the low income and the poor and putting many people on the street. And that's happening all over the country.
Reverend Bruce Wright, pastor director of Refuge Ministries. He helped establish the Tent City for the homeless in St. Petersburg, Florida. Thank you, Reverend Wright.
Thank you.
We leave you now with the song Walk On By, which is about the Tent City for homeless people in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Walk on by. Walk on by. St. Petersburg doesn't want you. Walk on by.
Walk on by.
You could buy a condo if only you would try. So walk on by. Walk on by.
You're listening to Here and Now.
As I walk through the city and enjoy how it has grown, I see you and your kind in Williams Park.
You're singing and you're laughing as if you were like me. But you've made me scared to go there after dark. You should thank your lucky stars.
Some Massachusetts social workers are planning to travel to a Texas detention center to meet with dozens of immigrants who were detained on charges of being in this country illegally after a raid on a factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts this week. Most of those detained were women. And after two young children were hospitalized with dehydration because their nursing mothers were detained in the raid, there are now questions about whether child care arrangements were made before these women were taken out of state. Harry Spence, commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Social Services, joins us to talk about this. Commissioner Spence, thanks for being with us.
I'm good to be here.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has said that he does not understand why the process following this raid on the Michael Bianco company turned into what he described as a race to the airport. And Homeland Security officials do say in their defense that they worked closely with the governor's office and with your office to make sure that children were cared for. What happened here?
Well, this past Monday, I had my first opportunity to talk to Homeland Security officials, asked at that time that we have access to the detainees either at the plant in New Bedford or at Fort Devens where they were moved to, and they denied us access at that time. They said there was no need for that. I indicated we'd be available 24/7 anytime, day or night, because we thought it was crucial that we were afraid that children were going to be abandoned, left behind in New Bedford with no care.
And that's what happened.
And that's what happened. On Tuesday, the area director in New Bedford repeatedly through the immigration officials sought access for social workers to the Fort Devens again to find out more. Again, was denied. Finally, on Tuesday afternoon and on Wednesday, Governor Patrick, together with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation, spoke to Secretary Chertoff and others in Washington. And finally, on Wednesday night, our social workers went in at 9:30 at night and met with 150 detainees until 6:30 in the morning. We found five juveniles in the group. We found 13 people that we believed there was strong evidence they were the sole caretakers of children. We found three pregnant women and the like. But they'd already flown out well over 100 people to Texas. And so we pointed out that this was a huge problem. There were likely similar profiles of people who were sole caregivers in Texas. And so they finally yesterday agreed in a phone call with the governor and Senator Kennedy and Senator Kerry and Congressman Delahunt and Congressman Frank, they agreed to give us access in Texas, so we're flying down as quick as we can make the arrangements with the federal officials.
And so you hope the social workers will be able to do the same thing, to sort of screen out exactly who's there and who
That's
may.
That's correct. And in the meantime, we've been able to identify dozens and dozens of children in New Bedford who are staying with temporary caregivers. They may be a babysitter, they may be a relative, but it's a very temporary arrangement. And we're trying to match that up now, those kids with the folks who are in who've been already flown to Texas, so that we can begin to talk to those parents and see if the federal government would at least release them back to Massachusetts until appropriate arrangements can be made for the care of their children. A number of these children are even U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a strange, as a child welfare professional, it's a strange circumstance where the federal government, which spends a great deal of time and money trying to ensure the safety and well-being of children and child welfare, is taking actions that then lead to children being abandoned.
Has your agency ever been in a situation like this before to send social workers out of state?
No, we send social workers individually and on individual cases out of state, not infrequently, because often there'll be a family member who can care for a child in another state or whatever, but usually just with one or two children and one or two social workers.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the goal, what's the overall goal here?
The overall goal here is to make sure that before a person who is a parent of a minor is deported, that appropriate arrangements are made for that child to be cared for. So children aren't simply on the street with their parents having been snatched away.
Right.
The trauma of that for the child is huge, obviously. And if there can be an orderly transition, the safety of the child is ensured, and at least there's also some opportunity for the child to come to terms with the loss of their mother or father.
Harry Spence, Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Social Services, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. It's a circus show without a big top, centered around a circus rehearsal full of the traditional acrobats, mime, trapeze sequences, and clowns. But there are no animals on stage. Instead, creator Daniele Finzi Pasca weaves in memories and images from his own past as the child of visual artists. His show, performed by the Montreal-based Cirque Elwaz, is titled Rain, and it's touring the U.S. this spring. Joining us from the CBC studios in Montreal are performers Crin Marin Haglund. Hello, Crin.
Hi.
Also with us is Jean-Philippe Couerrier. Welcome, Jean-Philippe.
Hi.
Hi. I want to talk about your careers first. Jean-Philippe, you started training for the circus when you were 8 years old, right?
Exactly.
Were you discovered, or how did that happen?
There was a circus school open in my town, and they did a big parade. And finally, I decided to jump in, and since then, I never quit.
You never quit.
But at the beginning, so at 8 years old, it's just for fun, you know, it's just like a hobby. And then if you want to push more, so you take more hours, and then you become a professional, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Unlike JP, I started circus pretty late. I didn't start until I was 21.
What were you doing until you were 21? Were you just sort of denying?
basically I was dreaming about the circus.
Really?
And that's actually true. I wanted to be in the circus since I was 4 years old. So for people who knew me my whole life, it's not a big surprise, but I kind of took another path in my high school and college. I expected I would get a job and circus would be my hobby. And then more and more, I spent more time training, and then I fell in love with it. And I realized, you know, it was kind of, for me, it was the first thing in my life that I wasn't afraid to be terrible at. I knew that if I was terrible at circus, I would never regret having tried to be a professional circus performer. Mm-hmm. So I'm very, very lucky that it's gone quite well. I started working with the Pickle Circus after a couple of years, and then really, I mean, because Montreal is such a hotbed of circus, I knew I wanted to come here.
I'm wondering, when you mention Montreal being such a popular place for circus, why do you think that is?
There's more of a European influence here. There's also a lot of support for the arts, as well as, there's Cirque du Soleil, which is here. There's the National Circus School. There's a couple of other circus companies. And so people in Quebec really recognize circus as an art form, and they have for a long time, like they do in Europe.
I think the influence of Europe mixed with the influence from America, if we mix them together with the dance and the theater, I think now we get something really from here. You know, it's not from Europe, it's not from United States, it's really from Quebec and Canada.
This particular performance, Rain. Karina, in the show, you perform in something called the Rue Cire.
Yes.
Can you describe that and what you do here? Because that's pretty amazing.
Sure. The Rue Cire is, I think the best way to describe it is it's like a giant hula hoop. You grab onto the edges. There's no handles. It's just a large wheel. And we spin around in the wheel. And I'm the first woman to perform it professionally. And my partner, Jonas Wolverton, and I, we spin and we
together,
go upside down
at the same time,
and we go together. We found a way to do that without ejecting each other, which it took a lot of practice. We kept throwing each other across the gym when we were learning, but basically with the wheel, when you go upside down, you just have to remember to lift your fingers up so you don't run them over.
Jean-Philippe, what about you in Rain? Can you describe what you do, what your leading role is in the performance?
My leading role is it's called teeterboard. It's like a seesaw that a person jump on it, and then I fly the other side, land on a mat, and I try to have fun with that and try to make people scare a little bit for me.
You both perform one act where you stuff into a suitcase another circus performer who appears to be unwilling, shall we say, at the very least. Let's listen to a clip of that right now.
No, please, you said you wouldn't do it anymore. Please, guys, no, Jimmy, I don't feel like it. Please, guys, please. No, stop it. No, it's not funny. It's not possible. Are you crazy? It won't work. No, I'm too fat. I have to work.
What happens is we tell the audience that this is the act where we put Nadine in the suitcase, and then JP and I proceed to prepare her body to go into the suitcase, and the sound effects here are generally the groans and moans of the audience as we stretch Nadine. She happens to be a contortionist, and we're not really hurting her, but it is quite surprising to watch if you're not used to seeing how contortionists can move. JP shoves her into the suitcase, and I push her in. And then JP jumps on top of the suitcase and closes it. And then we push her off the table. And she's in the suitcase. She is unharmed. So no contortionist is harmed in the making of this number.
Why do you think people are still mesmerized by the circus, Jean-Philippe?
It looks unreal. I mean, if you go see a movie, you know that maybe it's the 50th shot that they make of this scene. But when you go see a show live, you have one shot. You cannot take it back a second time.
You know, I think one of the things in Rain is that we don't show everything in Rain. Some things are hidden behind curtains, and some things are hidden even behind costumes. So we let the audience still use their imagination. We don't explain everything. I mean, so much in our world and our life is all laid out there for you, and everything is explained. And also, I think when you watch the circus, you love to see that it's hard. And as performers, that's something we have to remember. I mean, we don't get it right every time, and they like to, you know, really be supportive of us. So sometimes one of in Rain, we allow the audience to see, you know, if you don't do your trick right the first time, you do it again, because then the audience is there for you even more.
Do you think that because people are so used to seeing things on the screen or shows that are really fantastic, that can be computer generated now, there's a lack of appreciation of the humanity of doing things because of all the other things we're surrounded by?
But I think we go through the show together, with us and the audience. There's plenty of people who say after the show, I mean, this part, I would like to go on stage with you. And I was almost there, not physically, but in my head, I was with you guys. Mm. And it's a co-production.
Yeah. Right from the beginning, we let them see that there's a fragility to us. And we try to show that while we can do these things, we're also very human, and we, you know, it's the people, you know, even though they see all these fantastic, the technology is so amazing now, and people are so used to, you know, things that are true, you know, gigantic spectacles. I feel like when people watch our show, they calm down, and they open their minds and they open their imaginations for about 2 hours, and the audience can return to, you know, a place of being a little bit more like a child when they watch the circus.
Corinne Marin Haglund and Jean-Philippe Couturier are performers in the Montreal-based group Cirque Elwaz. Thanks very much to both of you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Cirque Elwaz is touring the United States this spring. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.